Welcome to the Venuccio Novak Report. This is Daria Novak reporting from Washington. Frank Venuccio will be back with us next week. This week we have as our guest co-host, John Wilson. John, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be joining you here from Florida.
You know, John, there's so many things to talk about this week in the news, but I think the one that we must start with is Venezuela. We have seen so many opinions and so many things happening in the news. Can you give us a little overview of what is actually happening versus what the liberal media in this country would like us to believe?
Well, what has happened is Manuel Noriega and other members of his administration, excuse me, I was going to talk about Noriega as well. That is the president of Venezuela that I'm trying to talk about. Maduro has an outstanding federal indictment for narco trafficking and for sponsoring terrorism. This indictment also includes various members of his administration. It is very reminiscent of Manuel Noriega. And believe me, I'm going to mix up the two again. It's going to
They're
happen.
not that different.
No, there's a lot of similarities. And that's what I think the much of the press today is trying to ignore. In 1989, 1990, then President George Bush, the elder, decided that Noriega was a danger running Panama, that he was engaged in narcotics trafficking, was supporting various activities of criminal cartels, and was an illegitimate president, and as such, was subject to arrest and extradition. You know that most heads of states have a sort of immunity from being arrested. Other countries really can't just go in to their fellow countries and seize their heads of state. But if that head of state is not a legitimate head of that state, not legitimately elected, and is engaged in criminal activities, then the United States, as the de facto enforcer of the world's order, does have the right to seize that person, extradite them to America, and have them stand trial. And that's exactly what's happened with Nicolas Maduro. He and his wife have been taken into custody and were arraigned recently in New York on these charges, where the only thing you heard from Maduro was his not guilty plea.
You know, John, I'd like to go through just a couple of the figures about the horror that went on under Maduro, because I think a lot of people just think, oh, America just wants oil. If you look at Maduro's human rights record, we have 10,185 plus executions under Maduro, 17,400 political arrests, 3,500 people disappeared, over 1,600 tortured, over 2,000 political prisoners. And this is perhaps the most shocking, I think. 332,617 violent deaths that can be attributed to this regime. You know, do we have a responsibility as leader of the world, as you said, to go in and to take action in places like these, or do we just ignore human rights abuses?
Well, it's more than just a matter of the human rights abuses that justifies American involvement here. It's the direct impact on the American economy and on American citizens that is crucial to understand. Why would we have cared that Manuel Noriega, and I'm using that example specifically, was engaged in narcotics distribution? Because those narcotics were making their way to our shores and killing our citizens. Now, the same thing has happened with Nicolas Maduro. Nicolas Maduro has run an empire that's premised upon drug sales. If I look at the indictment that was brought against Maduro, and if I could read from it briefly, it says that for 25 years, leaders of Venezuela have abused their positions of public trust and corrupted once legitimate institutions to import tons of cocaine into the United States. The "into the United States" part is what's crucial here. Yes, the world and the United States should be concerned by human rights abuses all across the globe and try to prevent that from happening. But much of that can be laid at the door of the United Nations. The United Nations is the primary institute for human rights abuses that don't specifically impact America or other countries, particularly things that are happening within the borders of a country. But when it comes to activity that's directly affecting the United States, such as these narcotic sales, that's killing our own citizens, then the United States definitely has a right to intervene.
Now, in the past, we've seen President Obama ordering forces to enter a sovereign nation without permission to kill Osama bin Laden, who is under a U.S. indictment issued in 1999, 98, excuse me. Under Clinton and President Trump, we saw forces to capture Maduro unharmed. Is there a lot of difference between this? We have a history in this country of going after individuals for prosecution in this country. Is this considered okay by Western nations or the UN in general?
There are international norms and international laws that are in flux. And if you speak to certain legal experts in international law, they'll tell you that all of this is illegal, that it's unjustified, that these matters should be handled in the International Court of Law. And to some extent, I'm not going to totally disagree with that position. But here we're talking about state actors, persons who are the leaders of large organizations that are killing American citizens. Those organizations sometimes are beyond the reach of the International Court of Law. And so it makes far more sense, especially when those persons are affecting the United States, that those persons be handled accordingly.
That makes sense. John, let's go to our first guest. Today we have Greg Sanfilippo. I hope I said that right, Greg, who's a former Marine Corps veteran who served overseas and a former member of the New York City Police Force, specializing in intelligence and counterterrorism. Today he serves as Vice President of Doyle Security Services in New York City. Greg has decades of law enforcement and military experience working to identify criminal and terrorist activity. Greg, welcome to the Venuccio Novak Report.
My pleasure, Derek. Thank you.
You know, so much is going on in the world today, Greg. We see cases domestically of fraud in Minnesota. We see China operating overseas very aggressively against other nations. We see trouble in the Middle East, of course, Maduro in Latin America. With all of this going on, how safe are Americans today, the average citizen, the people listening to this show?
Great question. Thanks for having me. I think we're a lot safer than where we feel, right? Because we get all this input, we get all this stories from everywhere, and realizing that our military, the first is on the forefront, the best in the world. Our first responders, best in the world, and out there. Proactively trying to keep us safe. And now in my new role, trying to take what we've learned from an intelligence standpoint, from a national level, at a law enforcement level, and then bring that down into the private sector security. And over the last decade, the gains on private sector security, that extra level of keeping us safe, has really grown leaps and bounds, and real excited about where it's going over the next few years.
Greg, do we have better public-private sector communication today and cooperation than we did after 9/11?
Absolutely. I mean, that really was the tipping point, horrific event that really got us to all those recommendations from the 9/11 report, right? That we need to share information better nationally, on down to the local levels, but not only within government organizations, but that information needs to then get out to those first responding agencies. Right, and having spend time with New York City Police Department, and and other cutting edge worked with other cutting edge law enforcement that really took that above and beyond, taking that information and being partners with fusion centers, being partners with national level intelligence operators. And now you're seeing that into the private sector, right? With those public-private partnerships, InfraGuard being one off the top of my head from a FBI, sharing information with public sector partners, near and dear to my heart, NYPD Shield, which takes a similar model, using the private sector security executives as extra eyes and ears, force multiplier. So, just two programs that highlight a number of other programs that, really look to enable the private sector to keep every average American citizen safe day to day.
Our John Wilson lived in New York City for a long time. Greg, you're in the New York area. What is it going to be like, do you think, for people in New York moving forward with Mamdani in office, with the terrorist threats that we see from overseas? Do you think people are going to be safe in New York in the future?
Another great question, Judge Sean. Thank you for your service as a born and bred New Yorker. So,
Thank you.
look, mayors change, right? I don't think it's one mayor to another. It's overcoming the change with one administration to another administration. I think that's the challenge, and that's specific to one mayor, one party. Every time those types of changes happen, the ripple down effect within those law enforcement organizations, in this case, not only NYPD, but other law enforcement that operates in the city, needs to digest and figure out what the directives are coming from the new executive. And in the end, NYPD, my other colleagues and other agencies will continue to work tooth and nail, keeping New Yorkers safe.
Let me jump in on that now at this time. And Greg, you may recall that I sat in Brooklyn Criminal Court. I was the night court judge there. I sat on a bench from 2005 until 2014. You might even recall my brother, Lieutenant Eddie Wilson. But whether you do or don't, thank you also for your service as well.
No, I do, Judge. I never came across your bench. I worked mostly in Manhattan my career, and then also in intel and counterterrorism. So I do remember your lineage, though.
You probably also know my good friend, James Verwaine,
Yes,
the Joint
sir.
Terrorism Task Force. Okay. All right. Now we've established all our credentials. I wanted to ask you more specifically about Mayor Mamdani. Mayor Mamdani's made some pretty tough statements right from the beginning about how he views Israel, and rescinded Eric Adams's executive order regarding anti-Semitism. That would point to Mayor Mamdani possibly being a threat himself. And I'm just wondering how the NYPD unofficially might be viewing a mayor who clearly is making some statements.
Yeah, absolutely. Again,
Demet for seize against Israel.
absolutely. My focus, Judge, is the life safety, and with the down to the public private sector with our clients, and enabling every average New Yorkers and average Americans that we engage with to be safe. I mean, the political argument as to, his statements with Israel aside, what needs to, carry forward is the gains and the progress that law enforcement agencies, especially, NYPD, has made over the last 4 years. And I'm very confident that Commissioner Tisch will continue some of those initiatives, intelligence-led policing, proactive policing, And just enabling the officers down at the street level to do their job and keep people safe.
You know, in New York, we've seen
Well, I mean,
a re-
let's.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was going to say let's get down to this issue then. Given the attitude of Mayor Mamdani, is it possible that he could get a threat assessment from the NYPD, from the intelligence unit, and tell them to stand down on the issue? And then what's NYPD going to do in that case?
Another good valid point, Judge. The mayor in the city of New York is the chief executive, and they are able to coordinate law enforcement initiatives from that standpoint, from administratively and organizationally. But the men and women in NYPD, like, it's not a cliche to say, like, we wake up and then sleep, all day long, with that thought in mind of keeping people safe. So, when it comes down to, keeping New Yorkers safe, I think that the mission continues and will, work its way through, these, political, ripples as we will find out here in the next few months.
You know, in recent years, especially in the last year or so, Greg, we've seen an uptick in religious violence, in particular anti-Semitism in this country and elsewhere. Do you see that these trends of violence will continue? Do you think it's going to peter out over time? Do you see any trends for 2026?
Yeah, there I'm hoping the and anticipate the trend in intelligence-led security to continue, and with that, enabling the reporting of these events. So yes, all these acts are heinous. What needs to happen is people need to continue reporting these. Some communities do well reporting these crimes. Other communities underreport. So, we need to get to a benchline going forward where we're equally from one faith group to another are reporting these acts. And, not only New York, around the country, with the intelligence getting to where it is, the reporting and the awareness, you'll see that these faith-based crimes, I think, will start to ebb here in 2020, towards the end of 2026.
John?
I just wonder more about how the NYPD is going to function under Mayor Mamdani, and I'm harping on that issue because it seems to be a serious matter.
It is a serious matter, right? A city of 8 million people, 16 million during the day.
Had the impression in Eric Adams, he having been a police captain, maybe a little glitch there, but anyway, having some confidence in Eric Adams, him being having been a police captain to some extent, and I agree with what you're saying about the continuity of NYPD over the many years, one mayor after another, different attitudes, but you do have a mayor now who has declared himself to be a democratic socialist, and it seems his policies are going to be incompatible with public order in a lot of ways. I'm just wondering how NYPD thinks it's going to be able to work with this mayor.
It's a great point. We're going to find out here in the weeks and months ahead, right? The public statements aside, it's the fiscal policy will really be a telling sign of will NYPD be able to operate the way we operated over the last 10, 20 years, or is there going to be a substantial change? And just like with following crimes and criminals, follow the money, that's what's going to tell. So if the budget stays the same, the overtime stays the same, then the crime fighting is going to stay the same, regardless of what the new mayor says out in public. You could be, chalking a good game as far as great policy, at the same time constricting the fiscal dollars, and then the crime fighting goes down because there's no money to get the men and women out there on the streets. So that's my one tip is follow the money, Judge.
Well, Greg, we always talk about the bad guys have to be right once. We have to be correct every single time. From a technological point of view, we have improved intelligence gathering, but we also have found there's a lot of weaknesses in our infrastructure in this country, whether it's electric grid, the financial world, water supplies. We could go on and on with the various areas. Do you think that we are improving our infrastructure protection, or are we still in a phase where there's a lot of problems that could happen?
Always a lot of problems that can happen. There's a lot of men and women that wake up every day, with the sole purpose of protecting that infrastructure, protecting our public, right? So, to your point, technology, being able to leverage that is going to be a key decider, going forward as to are we going to get ahead of the bad guys, or are they going to get ahead of us? So, we're at a point now where we're seeing, active shooting events, mass casualty events, and we happening in right in front of us, right? If you think of the Brown University incident, it's in front of us with our access to media, social media. So, the awareness is that much more heightened, and I think that's a good thing, right? There's bad points to that, right? Mental health, and but I think the good points to that is awareness, these issues being in the forefront to Judge's question, right? Is NYPD going to continue to operate well with this sense of awareness and where we are, and the criticality of keeping infrastructure and people safe, I think that we're going to continue on with a positive trend in life safety.
Do we see the corporate world responding? Are we protecting American citizens that work abroad as well as in this country better today?
Corporate, the corporate trends, we're seeing now is an increase in budgets that are going to what was once not a profit center, right? They weren't, corporations don't make money with security. They they're selling their goods or services. So for decades, security was always a cost center. It was an expense, and now with leveraging of technology, AI being one, is a huge force multiplier. Strategic partnerships with security, and as we mentioned before, intelligence, it's really gotten the private sector security to a level you've never seen in prior decades. And to my previous point on awareness, right, when we have these watershed events, the Park Avenue shooting, that really brings this to the forefront. I think that instance in particular is a paradigm changing instance where you're seeing a lot more resources going into private sector and corporate security.
Just to change gears a little bit, you've noticed, I'm sure, that there have been great success at the border with preventing the influx of illegal aliens. But at the same time, we've also seen a reduction in the amount of drugs that are making it through the border. Between the blowing up of narco terrorist boats and this general efforts at interdiction at the border, how is this beginning to impact New York? And is it beginning to impact New York?
Hard work that our colleagues down at the all the borders and fighting that influx, you will you start to see impact in the major cities. I think you're seeing it now. The initially when you start to see assault rates, murder rates, going down in some of these cities, New York in particular, with record low crime over the last 6 months. Definitely a huge impact from those efforts, and it's just a matter of seeing that forward, right? It's a little bit of a lagging indicator what goes on in the city because of all that supply that's already been allowed into the country.
Greg, if we look at New York City, we're looking at islands, limited access through bridges. It's a city that's highly populated, especially during the work week. How do you protect a city like that if there was a lone wolf incident? It seems that the reality is we're moving to lone wolf type of activities, I'll call them that, or disaffected citizens that may have mental health issues that may not be on a police intelligence list for potential problems. How do you protect such a large population in a condensed area?
It really gets back to the extra eyes and ears, those force multipliers, right? It seemed like when it was first thought up, post 9/11, see something, say something, right? Initially, it was MTA police came up with that slogan. It fit so well. It was thought up about if you saw something suspicious on public transportation to say something. And that saying, is really everywhere now, and it doesn't only apply to a suspicious package on a subway, right? So that, understanding, where people are and your friends, your family, understanding that when people are in crisis, who to call. So like, what's the something, that you should be aware of, and then what's the something that you should say, right? So it's, things that are just out of the ordinary, right? When you think, I think towards, the Brown University and the shooter there, right? What prior to that instance, what signs was he exhibiting that his friends or family could have highlighted and said, man, I knew something was off, right? We put the TV on and we'll hear stories about, so-and-so just snapped and never saw it happen. And then that's the sound bite. And then the investigation goes on, and we find out that that person didn't just snap. They exhibited, signs on that pathway to violence. So, we're getting so much better at that reporting, see something, say something in the tips line in New York City. It's NYC Safe, 888 NYC Safe. You could do it via email. Nationally, there's other tips lines, other cities have it. Every one of those reports, gets logged and gets investigated. So, whether it's someone that's just, having a bad day, or is it someone that's exhibiting signs that they're on that pathway? So we unfortunately we hear about the instances because they make the news when someone doesn't get caught. What we're not hearing is when someone does. And great story came out of, it was North Carolina, it was Mecklenburg, where a potential, active shooting, a terrorist event, was thwarted. And this particular case happened due to some online intelligence. But in this person's history had been a family member that had alerted the police towards that person that has those thoughts. Because a lot of times they're posting it online now. They're putting it in some sort of diary. So it's so important for friends and family just to keep and neighbors to keep an eye on each other. Not from a paranoia standpoint, but it's from a standpoint of, like, if someone is exhibiting stress and altered behaviors, how can we get them help?
Do we see this increasing since 9/11? Excuse me, not 9/11, more I want to say COVID. We see isolation of American citizens. And people that are isolated seem to have more problems when they're isolated from society. We see young people today that seem very stressed out. Does the data show anything that we're having increasing incidents in recent years?
So if you look at just active shooting instances, 2024 was a downtick. 2025 is going to be an uptick. I know that's just one snapshot, but if you look at the trend prior to that one down year, it had been an increasing trend. So without getting into all sorts of violent crime analysis, just using that as a snapshot, then the answer is yes, unfortunately, right? I'm not a medical health professional, but isolation is not a good recipe for someone that's having mental stressors. And unfortunately, now with technology, as all the great advances that it's brought us, the downside is you're able to sit someone that has some sort of evil intentions or negative thought. Can sit online and find someone of a like mind, right? So they'll sit in these. I had a mentor call it the echo chamber of hate, right? So they'll sit online in these chat rooms and they'll only talk to people of like mind, and they're having mental distress. So that's the point where it's able. People are able to then. If they're able to see that and step in at that point, and that's the see something, that's the something of the see, right? Someone that's all of a sudden, isolating themselves. However, they're talking, online to groups that are of similar mindset.
Greg, thanks for joining us today. I'd like to thank you for your service as both a Marine and as a police officer and your continuing service to the American public. Can you tell us how people could find out more about you and about your company?
Absolutely. They can find information on Doyle Security Services, DOYLE, securityservices.com. And our goal is to bring in this intelligence-led security to continue with all the advances that we've seen and bring this to the level that we'll see intelligence being shared on national law enforcement levels to bring that to private security.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We'll have to have you back on.
Pleasure. Thank you,
Thank
Greg.
you. Thank you. You know, John, I'm always interested when we have people on the show that have really been there and done it in the trenches. They really know what's going on. They tell us the truth and they speak openly about what's happening. Let's go to our next guest, John. Today we have with us Drew Allen West. He's an author. He wrote the book For Christ and Country, The Martyrdom of Charlie Kirk. This is a book that courageously declares the truth too many are afraid to say. The left killed Charlie Kirk, not with a single bullet, but with years of hatred, slander, moral corruption. Drew argues that Kirk's death was not an isolated act of violence, but the culmination of a toxic political movement that has gone mainstream and is now fully embodied in the Democratic Party. Drew, welcome to the Venuccio Novak Report.
Hey, good to be with you. Thank you.
We really appreciate your coming on today. You know, these are sensitive topics. Anytime we mention the left, Charlie Kirk, the Democratic Party, when you put these things together in your book, you're calling it out and saying it like it is. Are there others out there doing it, or are you one of the few?
Well, I think Dan Bongino, if I have any suspicion, is about to unleash hell on everyone that doesn't, toe the righteous line based on what I'm seeing after his departure from the FBI. But yeah, no, I think it's happening. I think that I'm hopefully being one of the most vocal people right now because I have sort of a platform and I'm a publicist and I've been an author for a while. But part of this book, which is what I hope makes it special for people, is that it's very personal. It's about my own experience my personal experience with Charlie dying, with that assassination, I mean, it really broke me down and it rebuilt me as a better man, somebody who wanted to be more courageous, who didn't care anymore about criticism from the left or, people attacking me for speaking the truth. Because I watched some guy get killed over it, not just some guy, but somebody that I had at least a professional relationship with because I was his publicist in 2024 for Right Wing Revolution. And I just thought, it's a strange thing. I mean, you watch that happen, which is an act of violence, and obviously nobody wants that for themselves or their family. But it didn't make me more timid because of that action. It made me want to be more vocal, and that's kind of where I'm at.
Do you think that's happened with Americans across the country, that that assassination woke people up? They realized that things had gone too far? Do you think the Americans will hide under the shell with their short news cycle?
Well, it's sort of happened. It definitely woke people up, okay? And people out there are still struggling with it. They're still having this experience. Charlie Kirk hasn't forgotten right now, but there should have been a reckoning after his assassination that didn't happen. I mean, this is, we need to call it out like it is because we have a very serious problem in this country, and it is left-wing violence. And the left uses all kinds of cooked books and propaganda to try and convince you that these are unique one-off circumstances, that they're not responsible in any way with their rhetoric, dehumanizing people. But it's not true. I mean, I could go through a long list, but I'll keep it short. I mean, Rand Paul had his ribs broken by a neighbor who was a Democrat supporter. It was over political disagreement and a hatred to Rand Paul. And the left, actually, the media, mainstream media, made fun of it, made light of the event. You had Steve Scalise, who almost died when a Bernie Sanders supporter shot up the congressional baseball team, Republicans that were practicing. You had an assassination attempt on Donald Trump that only got his ear. Thank God. He survived. We have transgender attacks on churches, on schools, on our young children. And when you read their manifestos, they sound like Barack Obama speeches or Joe Biden speeches. And that's not hyperbole. The rhetoric that's in there, the hatred that they are spewing, you can listen when you turn on CNN. So there is a correlation between the rhetoric of the left and the violence that's taking place, and they need to be held accountable.
Well, whenever, go ahead, John.
Yeah, I wanted to get more into that and understand the trend we're talking about. You're identifying that there is a left-wing agenda here, but could you tell me what you think the goal of this left-wing agenda of violence would be?
Yeah, I mean, it's like akin to the French Revolution. It's a combination of that with, your standard communism out of the Soviet Union. It's just destruction. These people, I mean, it's hard for people on the ground that aren't like conniving maniacs like a Gavin Newsom or a Mamdani who wake up every single day like thirsting for power, hunger for power. Most of us just want to go about our lives, right? I want to take care of my family. I want opportunities. But at the end of the day, they have a deep spiritual rot in at the core of all of this. I mean, this is what you can't talk about these types of movements without talking about a spiritual component. Because at the root of the left's ideology, it is an antipathy for obviously God. These people often put themselves on pedestals, view themselves as gods. They believe in moral relativism. Right and wrong is simply what they want it to be at any given moment. They don't believe in transcendent power as I do and most conservatives do. And frankly, level-headed Americans believe in, there is, objective right and wrong. There are biological truths. And so it's a destructive ideology. I mean, why do radical Islamist terrorists and Muslims, these particular jihadists, why do they go and blow up buildings? Why do they fly into the Twin Towers? I mean, it's just a hatred and a desire to tear something down.
But do you see an organized component to this activity? I mean, we've seen in the news that the protesters at every week's new protest. One week it's pro-Palestine, another it's gays for Palestine. Another protest has been in favor of Somali daycare workers. Every week seems to be something new. Do you see a certain organizational component to this? And if so, who might be the one that's organizing this?
Well, there's many people behind it. I mean, the name you're not supposed to say that they George Soros, obviously. I mean, he's been behind every dark deed in my lifetime, it appears, whether it's the Trump Russia collusion hoax that turned into a coup under Barack Obama, whether it's, yeah, these protests in the streets on college campuses around the country. Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is it's really interesting because true revolutions in the sense of like the American Revolution, right? 1776, what happened here? That was largely organic. It sprung from enlightenment, frankly, and an understanding of history and a desire for freedom. These were positive desires. But if you look at even, the Soviet Union, other places, these are not really organic movements. They require a lot of organization. They require, in the case of a lot of these protest movements, these are paid protesters and agitators. And it's beyond that too, because they have to prep. Like a lot of what we're seeing with this, and it is a Marxist revolution that I believe is the end goal, but you're looking at them taking over schools. Look what Charlie Kirk did on college campuses. He'd show up for 2, 3 hours and he would try and free their brains from the brain rot of the university. So, there's a lot of effort that's gone into creating these little stormtroopers for, whether you want to call it, socialism or Marxism or communism. I mean, ultimately, they're all, kindred ideologies that deny reality itself. Like rent control apartments, we know they don't work, but like every left wing a policy, they're rooted in some supposed, moral effort, but the ultimate outcome of those is the opposite of even what the best intention could be.
Drew, we have three-pronged approach from the left through the entertainment industry, through the media, and we, well, so many different approaches, I should say, and education is really the third. How do young people today stand up when what they hear and read in the news, what they're taught in the schools, etc., when they're overwhelmed with this false information? Where literally the left has said anybody who's MAGA, anybody who's a Trump supporter is, a whole bunch of names I probably shouldn't even call on air, but crazy. How do we get a balance back?
Well, I think that individual Americans who have already kind of gotten to a point, like myself, for example, who is in a place of maturity and genuine, I think, confidence about my beliefs. I mean, I'm 38. I've been studying this stuff for a long time. Charlie Kirk's death definitely sped up my process of transformation. But the real, I think, transformational element for me that allows that to be possible is faith. So I noticed something about myself is that even as a Christian, it was really low on my list of priorities. I mean, I'm a good guy. I'm a father. I've got 2 young kids. I'm married. But in terms of really putting my faith first or making an important part of my life, it wasn't. And I can tell you and people from experience that when I began to actually make those changes in my life to try and do what Charlie Kirk did, which was to really dig deep into his spirituality, his own relationship with God and his understanding, it freed me. And it gave me, because look, I grew up in liberal environments. So I worked in Milan, Italy, in fashion for Marc Jacobs for 2.5 years. I went to an elitist all-male college prep school, a Jesuit school in Dallas. I was a theater major. I was an actor for a long time. So these were environments where I was around liberals, but I lost all my friends that I'd had since childhood, even with the 2020 election. And that was when I realized we had a problem because they didn't abandon me in 2016 when I voted for Trump. It was 2020. So they had 4 years, right, of this dehumanization. And so 2020, even though I hadn't changed, they decided that they would, I had to be excommunicated simply because of my political beliefs. And that stung and it hurt. And it took a long time to get over because nobody wants to have that experience in their life. Nobody wants to be hated and maligned. So you've really got to have a concrete understanding of right and wrong and spirituality. And that's the only thing I can tell people that is going to allow you to get to a place like Charlie Kirk was at.
So I'd like to ask a question. Now, I recall being at memorials for Charlie Kirk after his assassination, and I remember the outpouring of feeling and being surprised at the thousands of people that I saw in attendance at these memorials. But since that time, we've heard a lot of criticism in the media, and the number one criticism I hear is about Charlie Kirk supposedly having a heart full of hatred and having been hating transgenders. You knew Charlie Kirk. You knew him personally. I'd like to hear your refutation of this position, and I'd like to hear your answer to those who just hold this without thought, this position.
Well, sure. And I mean, I had a professional tie. I mean, I didn't break bread with a guy, but I understand Charlie Kirk and what he stood for, and it's in the book too. Charlie Kirk didn't have any hatred in his heart. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. That line of logic and talk, that propaganda that comes from the left, is built on this bastardization of Christian faith, for example, which is to say that, Jesus just says, love one another. What does love look like? Does love mean condoning lies and condoning sin? It does not. So the like if you have somebody in your life who's an alcoholic, drinking up and waking up in the morning and boozing all day, and they're killing themselves, is it an act of love to buy that person alcohol to feed that addiction? Or is it love to say, hey, stop it. You're killing yourself. I'm not going to condone your drinking. You're doing something that's wrong. It's harming yourself and people around you. And that's objective truth. So with the transgender community, it's the same situation. There are biological realities. There's male and female. And an act of love is to say, look, you're going down a path that's not going to lead to happiness. I am going to show you and offer you, real solutions to deal with the underlying concerns. So when Charlie Kirk would speak out about transgenderism, he's the one that loved them. Not the left that wants little kids to chop off their wee-wees.
Drew, the way that you're talking, it made me think of this question. Years ago, we played with our neighbors, we barbecued with our neighbors. Politics weren't important, positions weren't important. They were neighbors, they were Americans, they were people we cared about, people that when they were ill, we took them, chicken noodle soup. Today, we see Americans moving to parts of the country to be with people that think like they think. If it's one thing to be in a community, but if you move cross country, you can't just pick up your household and move back again. Are we creating long-term divisions where Americans view other Americans as the enemy?
Yes, we are. We are. But I think that what's happening on the right with like conservatives, it's reactionary. And you could relate this to Israel and quote unquote Palestine, Israel and Iran, Israel and whatever else. I mean, it's very hard to get along with somebody who doesn't believe you have a right to even be alive anymore. In the case of Charlie Kirk, he was nothing more than a clump of cells to the left that celebrated. Think about it. The reaction from mainstream Democrat politicians and people I knew from high school, it was a lot of people. It was a lot of people on the left, teachers, police officers, firefighters in some cases around this country that were celebrating his death and mocking it. These are the people that we're dealing with. And, you've got to be a realist. Now, the people on the right, conservatives, I mean, we're always going to be more inclined to extend some sort of olive branch. Now, I'm not going to make concessions about morality to them, but I don't dehumanize my enemy. You can love your enemy. I mean, even as Jesus Christ tells you to do, but it doesn't mean that that enemy, you're going to condone what they're doing and take on their attitudes and behaviors and ideologies for yourself. So it's really important that conservatives, and look, I mean, if you want to, I mean, I don't know how to do this except to make a bunch of Christian analogies, frankly, right now, because it's a spiritual war. But if your objective is to go forth and make disciples of all nations, and you got somebody in a coffee shop that is interested in learning about, God or whatever else. I mean, it's on you, it's on the individual citizen to take up this mantle that Charlie Kirk left for us and to be able to do that politically about issues out there, right? Like, there's a burden with being a conservative on the right side of history because you can be on the left and be lazy. All you have is propaganda and lies. So we have to educate ourselves. We have to strive for improvement and knowledge and wisdom to share that with other people.
Wow, that's pretty, if that's an important message, I think, to get out there. Do you see Charlie Kirk's legacy? Real quick, because we'll have only a short time, but do you see his legacy as a lasting one, as expanding? We immediately after his assassination saw a lot of new turning point chapters, but do you think that this is a con going to continue to expand?
I don't know how long Teep USA will live on. I hope for a long time that they can keep it together. But absolutely, his legacy will live on in each of us. I mean, I think that we'll look back at Charlie Kirk. I mean, I say he's a martyr. He is to me and many other people out there. That's a legacy that it won't go away because he personally changed my life with the way he lived his life and what he stood for in his death. And so that will live on with me and probably millions of other people who feel the same way.
Drew Allen West, thank you so much for being on the show today. Could you tell us where people could get your book and follow your work?
Yes. So for Christ and Country, The Martyrdom of Charlie Kirk, they can now buy on Amazon. They censored it for like 3 weeks, but I think we're past it now. I'm the number one book in the LGBTQ plus category. And it's kind of trolling the left, but also I have a chapter about transgenderism. Obviously, that's very important to read. But that's good. DrewAllen.substack.com is another place they can subscribe and follow.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. We hope to talk to you again in the future.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank
Yes. Thank
you.
you.
We welcome our newest markets today in Odessa, Texas at 93.3 FM, Liberty, Missouri, 89.5 FM, and in later Butler, Alabama, 96.3 FM. We're expanding into a number of major media markets, including Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM. Las Vegas, Nevada at 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida, 92.1 FM, Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM, Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM, Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM, Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM, Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM, Tucson, Arizona, 95.5 FM, and Provo, Utah at 90.5 FM. We're also available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, Spreaker, and the Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune in to our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and Public Broadcast TV. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc., at usagovpolicy.com and the International Center for Great Power Studies and Diplomacy. Email us at truthinradio@gmail.com and tune into the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network.